Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and this week on the show, we have an actor who has quietly managed to give some of the most consistently funny performances on TV over the past 15 or so years. You probably know Zach Woods as Gabe from The Office, or maybe Jared from Silicon Valley. Now he's added a new deeply uncomfortable character to his repertoire, public radio host Lauren Caspian, on a new series premiering this week on Peacock called In the Know. The show, which Zach co-created with Mike Judge and Brandon Gardner, mixes stop-motion animated characters with live-action footage of actual celebrities like Mike Tyson, Ken Burns, Jonathan Van Ness, and others, who play themselves as the interview guests on the fictional radio show that's sort of like a third-rate Fresh Air with Terry Gross. As I tell Zach at the top of our conversation, this parody of what it's like to interview famous people on Zoom hit a little too close to home for me. You know, in the best way. Zach and I spend a lot of time in this episode talking about how intimidating it was to join The Office in its sixth season, and the experience of getting to help define a show like Silicon Valley from the very beginning. But I want to start with a scene from In the Know, in which his character Lauren greets intern Chase, played by Charlie Bushnell, and clashes with his boss Barb, who is voiced by J. Smith Cameron, aka Jerry from Succession.
Chase, interns are supposed to get here by 9. We've talked about this.
Dude, it's crazy I even came in. Last night, this couple I was banging accidentally locked me in their home sensory deprivation tank. And I was freaking screaming all night.
What, they didn't hear you?
They're both deaf. Techno accident. But they still DJ, which is inspiring as...
Good morning, everyone. Ready to have a great show?
Oh, Barb, you know I can't have management hovering over me before interviews. Mm. The last thing I need is some corporate fat cat purring money, money, money in my ear.
You make twice my salary.
It's not all about money, Barb.
Okay, showtime.
Scrooge McDuck.
Boomer witch.
Zach, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here. And I have to tell you that I've just finished watching all six episodes of your new show, In the Know, and I loved it so much. I really, really enjoyed it.
I can't believe you watched, first of all, watching one show, one episode, sets you apart from the vast majority.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, people have to write a million things and do a million podcasts, and they, you know, it's just, I don't know that I would watch all the shows, but to watch all six is really amazing. Thank you so much for doing that.
Well, I would have watched it either way, but I was thankful that they're like in the 22-ish minute range, and there are six of them, so that made it doable. But
good.
But it was very enjoyable. And so you play the host of an NPR type show who interviews celebrities, and the beginning of the show, we see you sort of practicing your intro in the mirror. And I have to tell you, as someone who interviews celebrities on a podcast, I felt a little bit too seen by this program.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was like, you know, the thing about Lauren is like, he's so uncomfortably close to me in a way that I really, really wish weren't true, but is true.
What do you have in common with him?
Oh my God, probably like bone density, smug moral self-satisfaction that is not backed up by your actual life, venal self-involvement. I the most devastating thing that happened was the other day, my girlfriend was like, oh, you're doing your mirror face. And I was like, what? She was like, your mirror face. It's like, what are you talking about? She's like, oh, you know, you like when you look in a mirror, you do this thing. And I was like, oh my God, I'm subconsciously adjusting my features in what I guess think is a more flattering configuration. I may as well just roll into the LA River and let me carry me away to the sea.
Well, this guy, Lauren Caspian, I'd say he looks a little bit like Ira Glass. I don't know if that's intentional. He has a little bit of Terry Gross going on in the way the way you do the interviews and the kind of style of show you're doing. What were the sort of how would you describe him and what was the sort of inspiration for that character?
Physically, he is sort of a Frankenstein of a million different NPR hosts. Like he's like part Michael Barbaro, who's, I guess, not strictly speaking NPR, part Terry Gross, part Ira Glass.
You kind of do the Michael Barbaro thing.
Yes. Ezra Klein, this whole kind of tribe of Malcolm Gladwell. We didn't restrict ourselves to specifically National Public Radio, but we did a kind of the public intelligentsia kind of East Coast, mostly, you know, public intellectual / NPR set. But the origin of the character was, I think it was kind of gradual in the sense that for a long time, I've been fascinated by, and also I've had very complicated feelings about the list of people I just, I adore. I always thought if I couldn't be an actor, like when people have said, like, if you could be an actor, a director, a writer, what would you do? I often would answer, I would love Terry Gross's job. I just think the idea of being able to take in beautiful and fascinating things and then ask questions of the people just seems like a dream job. I also find that in conversations with people, probably through as a result of my own shyness and my curiosity and others, I end up asking a lot of questions. So I think I share that with Lauren. And then there's a kind of puckish, like intellectual naughtiness that some people have, where it's kind of like the test of an idea isn't actually how truthful it is or how much it reflects reality. It's how much of a kind of delicious take it is, where it's, you know, it's like, doesn't matter whether something is accurate or sincere. It's just kind of like, well, everyone agrees that violence is wrong, but what if it wasn't, you know, that kind of feeling where it's like, dare I challenge the sacred cows? You know, like, it's like that kind of feeling. And I always find that to be like, just makes me climb the walls. So that's the sort of broad strokes of like where he's from for me. But the show was created with Mike Judge and Brandon Gardner. And I'd worked for a long time with Mike on Silicon Valley. And he'd noticed that I end up sort of interviewing people naturally in conversation, and he also noticed how I kind of waft NPR-ness around wherever I go, and so he was like, well, what if we did a show that was a stop motion show that had interviews where you're playing some sort of an NPR host? And I was like, right. And what if his name's Lauren Caspian and his girlfriend's also named Lauren? And we came up with this whole backstory where we didn't end up using it, but where his girlfriend, he brags about how his girlfriend is a dreamer under DACA, but actually she's just like an undocumented graduate student from Montreal who like just snuck into the country. And so he's just constantly trying to claim his sort of portion of heroism that doesn't belong to him. But what I was going to say with the interview thing, I think something we really tried to do and something I really admire Mike Judge for is that I feel like when he does satirical stuff, it's both totally unsparing and like cutting in a way, but it's also kind of warm, and it doesn't, the satirical point of view is not from on high looking down. It's like lateral. It's like, instead of aren't these people assholes, it's like, aren't we all such assholes? And that actually is in more my worldview. It's like, I don't think I'm better than the people who are virtue signaling. I'm probably one of them more often than not. And so we wanted to try to understand the core needs, wounds, desires that motivate people to act in these kind of cringy ways, and to give each part equal due, both the obnoxious behavior and then the kind of more sympathetic, recognizably human, lovable, flawed thing that's underneath the surface of the ocean, the part of the iceberg that you don't see, but that is most of it, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, in your announcement of the show, you had a quote where you said, public radio reflects aspects of ourselves that we're embarrassed by. So it sounds like it's something along those lines where it's you identify, as you said, with this character and with this world, but that there's something about it that makes you uncomfortable at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. One of the things that made us, like early on, that helped give us the ideas, it was right after George Floyd had been murdered, and there was a lot of, you know, probably everyone remembers what that time was like wherever they lived. And I was in Larchmont, which is a neighborhood in Los Angeles that's very she and wealthy. And I saw on somebody's front lawn, there was a sign that said, defund the police. And then next to that sign was an ADT home security decal that mentioned that they had armed guards.
that sums it up.
And I was like, what? I was just like, Jesus Christ. It's like, defund the police, but also we have armed mercenaries to protect our, like,
yeah,
our Audi SUV. It's just like, come on. Yeah, I feel that way a lot. Something that I just don't think my ideology, I don't know that the person I would like to be, I think the distance between the person I would like to be and the person I am is vast, particularly when it comes to kind of ideological stuff. You know, I sometimes worry about that where I'm like, is this all just cosmetic? Is it like,
yeah, performative.
Without even knowing it, are the things that I believe just, you know, a kind of rouge I'm powdering my face with? Or is it something that I am prepared to walk the walk on? And it's an ongoing question. I try not to be completely passive about that. When I have those thoughts, I try to think, well, what would walking the walk look like? And do a little bit of it. But I fall very far short of what a reasonable person would think is enough.
Yeah, it was interesting what you're saying about the sort of lateral satire, because you could imagine a version of this show that is a satire of public radio sort of made by the right that is very different and a lot less empathetic and a lot broader, I guess, or just not as sort of understanding about what this world is. So that must have been, was that something that was on your mind? Like, you didn't want to make, you didn't want to just make like progressives the punchline entirely or sort of, you know, make it come off like, do you think that, I guess the question is, do you think someone, you know, who has that view of NPR would enjoy the show, or did you maybe not want to play too much into that and make it that the audience?
That's a great question. Certainly the purpose of the show was not to just be like the workplace comedy of the January 6th riot, yeah, insurrectionists. Like, yeah, that,
well, it's not on Fox Nation either.
Yeah, but I think because there's such factionalism and people are so dug in politically and in terms of their identity, I do feel like there isn't that much self-ridicule happening across with the political divide. In other words, I would be so fascinated if some Trump person like owned and made fun of what was excessive about themselves. I even if I really, you know, that would really interest me. On the left too, I think, like, if the left was being more self-reflective and like, you know, like, well, we are, you know, it's like, I think there's something interesting about that if it's funny. You know, I think that's the big test, is like, is it funny? And I was always like fascinated by that, because to me, art, comedy, etc., that is the one of the places where you can really complicate people, where you can splinter people, or maybe splinter isn't even the right word, where you can show the multidimensionality and the conflicts, the inner conflicts and contradictions. And to me, that is why I love TV, films, art of various forms, because it makes me feel less alone. Because when I interact with people in the world, I don't experience them as one thing usually. Usually they're like a very confusing, beautiful, frustrating scramble of like 17 things. And just living in that kind of bird's nest with them is like a real adventure. And I guess what we wanted to do is show people who have many different contradictory aspects. And I think the more we can experience ourselves and each other that way, as being not just one thing, but a lot of different things all at once, then my hope would be that if we could do that more, then we would have more of an appreciation for our own ridiculousness, more empathy for the other people, you know, maybe even more conviction because we'd know, I don't know. I guess I'm starting to sound like Lauren, like describing the utopia on the other side of my 20-minute stop motion comedy.
Yeah.
How obnoxious. But do you know what I'm saying? Does any of this make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it is a rare show in the sense of that sort of self-parody in a way that it's not punching down at the other. It's kind of like looking introspectively in a way, which makes it sound, as you said, a lot more serious than it is for a show that is full of some pretty absurd jokes and is a stop motion animation and all of that. I want to ask about the interviews, which are a big part of the show. And you mentioned, you know, people like Mike Tyson and Nora Jones. I'm just sort of fascinated by the logistics of that because you're having these, it's real. We see the real people for anyone who hasn't seen the show yet in a sort of like Zoom setting. But they're talking to your character who is a stop motion animation character. How did you go about making those work? What was it like for the guests? How did you prep them? What did you sort of tell them was happening? And how did you pull that off?
We had this amazing booker named Hillary who worked on The Daily Show. So she really allowed us to punch above our weight in terms of guests. Like a first season animated, a stop motion animated show where there's nothing for them to look at. It's like a kind of dicey proposition for actors and thinkers, celebrities, whatever, you know. So she got us really amazing guests. Then the way it worked is they would be on Zoom, similar to what we're doing now. And when they turned on their Zoom, Brandon Gardner, who directed, co-created, ran the show with me, would talk to them and say, here's how it's going to work. It's going to be an interview. Just treat it like a normal NPR interview. And you don't have to pretend to be offended. If you're not offended, you can laugh. If something strikes you funny, just be yourself. Just react naturally. That's it. In a minute, when we start the interview, you'll just see a still image of Lauren Caspian and you'll be talking to him. And so then he would switch over and it would just be a picture of Lauren, just a still photo so that they weren't looking at my face. And we would talk for about an hour. And then I would have an iPad with a Google Doc open where Brandon would have this reservoir of questions that our writers had come up with. And he would help curate which question was next and kind of like mission control, you know, and sometimes would like write a joke or pitch a joke or something. So I could see that on the iPad as I'm talking to them.
And that's all happening sort of live during the interview. Wow. Yeah. So you have to really, I mean, I know you have an improv background, but that's some pretty high level improv with these real people and sort of doing this interview in character with jokes, you know, live.
Yeah. I mean, it was fun. Yeah. But yeah, it's a little overstimulating. I would just like pound Coke Zeros right before. It's amazing how one of the things is like, that's almost like chastening or something. You know, I've spent so much of my life learning how to improvise and all that stuff. And then I would interview these people who have no background in that. And they would be so funny and deep and roll with the punches. Tegan and Sarah did this great bit. Like, we'd never met each other. They were like immediately like understood like how to play back and forth. Finn Wolfhard was so everyone. Mike Tyson gave these like profound, like very deep answers. I mean, I was just shocked by how well everyone rolled with the punches and revealed themselves. You know, it's really incredible.
Now, Michael, when you're training for a fight, you famously listen exclusively to moody folk music.
No. Where I'm training, nothing but hardcore hip-hop, hardcore. The most destructive hip-hop, the most vile hip-hop, that's what I listen to when I train.
Right, but you must have trained to Carole King's rendition of You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman.
I would never use that song, sir.
What about Joni Mitchell?
No, I would not use Miss Mitchell.
Buffy St. Marie?
No.
Joan Baez?
No, listen.
Patti Smith? Vashti Bunyan? The McGarrigle sisters.
No.
But our researcher Fabian insisted that you love to shadowbox while listening to Ladies of the Canyon.
No, Fabian fucked up.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say that, Michael, because anytime I give any constructive criticism, she says all feedback is violence.
Well, violence is a state of mind. It's perspective on violence. That's not violent to you, but it's violent to her.
Well, Michael, if you like strongly worded hip-hop, you should listen to Lin-Manuel Miranda's rap about the West Wing. It's deliciously funky.
Was there anyone, was there a moment that stands out where someone really kind of rolled with it in a surprising way or you know, came up with a joke that you were not expecting that made it into the show?
Mike Tyson opining on loss was like crazy. I mean, I've been fascinated by Mike Tyson for many years, and I've watched a million documentaries and Broadway show and books and stuff. And the combination, it's sort of what we were talking about before, being many things at once. Mike Tyson has been everything, right? He's been one of the kind of discarded, basically, you know, when he was a little kid, just one of the people who was just like allowed to live in really difficult circumstances without much in the way of support. Then he was the most, you know, famous athlete in the world, or one of them. You know, he's been on every side of every dynamic, I think. You know, the scary guy, the guy who's terrified of the world. Anyway, rich, not rich. So talking to him, I just wanted to kind of, it was one of the only times I sort of resented at moments the obligation to be Lauren, because I just wanted to ask him questions. And at one point I just said, do you ever feel protective of the little kid that you used to be, because he was up against so much? And he goes, no, he must walk through the fire. He must be burnt. And that was like, whoa, that's such an intense thing to say. And then another one was Roxane Gay. Roxane Gay, you know, writes editorials for the New York Times. She's a progressive writer. You know, she's this like, she was so funny. A lot of times her columns will be serious, you know, her stuff will be quite serious. She was really funny and kind of like provocative and playful. And she was so wonderful and down to clown, like in a way that I was like, whoa, this is amazing. Like, yeah, I was really impressed by her.
I don't want to reveal too much about the last episode, but you do have quite a lot of fun with Hugh Laurie, who's someone I know you've worked with before. Seems like you treated that one maybe a little differently.
Hugh Laurie has a magic face. I really believe this. Hugh Laurie's face, I don't know. He can express, I feel like a broken record here, because it's the same thing. His face can express three emotions all at the same time. When I got my first television job, I went online and someone had posted a picture of me and they said, his face looks like a combination of sadness and food poisoning. But Hugh Laurie, for example, his face could look like more than just sadness and food poisoning. It could look like sadness and food poisoning and desire, or sadness and food poisoning and elation, or whatever. I mean, I don't think his face looks like sadness and food poisoning, but I guess I think I understood their point about me.
Was that when you joined The Office that somebody made that observation?
Yeah, I hadn't even been in an episode yet. I was like, oh boy.
They just saw your picture of you?
I was like, buckle up, here we go.
Coming up, much more on what it was like for Zach to get his first real TV job on The Office. And later, how working on Silicon Valley made him distrust the tech world, and why, despite that, he just decided to join TikTok at the beginning of 2024.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to our episodes with some of Zach's former co-stars, like The Office's Mindy Kaling and Craig Robinson, Silicon Valley's Thomas Middleditch and Jimmy O. Yang, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Wednesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple and Spotify to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Zach Woods. I was looking back at your work on that show, and it's just kind of, it was interesting to think about what it must have been like for you as your first TV job, really, joining the show in season six after it had been very well established. And you're kind of coming in as almost an authority figure for these characters, not one that's maybe respected that much, but
no.
But it was kind of a strange, power dynamic, which is a big part of improv. What was it like for you to kind of come into that show in that way?
Abject terror. Just so scared. There, for a while, there were these children's movies where some kid would end up playing major league sports. Like, I don't know, there's like Rookie of the Year or something where kid breaks his arm and then it heals in such a way that he can throw fastballs. Yeah, yeah. And then he ends up playing for the... I felt like that. I felt like it was just like all of a sudden it's, I've been like playing stickball in the streets with my friends. And then it's like you're at the World Series and it's just like, oh my God, what am I supposed to do here?
Had you auditioned for the show when it started, or were you not even sort of there yet in your, your career?
No, I never auditioned. And this this spectacularly kind and supportive casting director named Allison Jones, who basically has populated American comedy, just we had a meeting in LA and she just said, I'm going to help you. And then she helped me. And it was like, I've talked about this before. And when I would say, like, for someone in Hollywood to say to someone who has nothing to offer them, I want to help you. And then to mean it is such an anomaly. But Allison Jones said it, which was strange, and she meant it, which was even stranger. And I will be forever in that woman's debt. She just got me on the show. They wrote a part for me. It's crazy.
Wow. Yeah. What are your memories of actually, going on set for the first time and shooting your first scenes?
Was surprised by the layout. You watch a show for enough years, you kind of think you know where things are, and then you walk in, you're like, wait, that's where the bullpen is and that's where the HR is? That makes no sense. So that was, I felt betrayed by the by the geography of the space. I felt shocked by how kind everyone was. You have the kind of fantasy of like, you can't sit here big dogging Hollywood stuff. You think like, oh, am I going to be the freshman who, people shove in a locker? It could not have been more the opposite. Everyone was so warm. Kate Flannery went way out of her way to be so kind to me. Leslie and Phyllis and everyone, they were just so warm and immediately just, in not a showy way, just kind of made me feel at home. And yeah, I remember shooting the first thing that I ever shot, which was a talking head. And John Krasinski was directing that episode. And he just let me improvise for a really long time. I think my guess is they were running behind in the day because of it took a while, to get to me that day. And so in an industry where time is money and everyone... a show like that too, people, if you run late, maybe people don't get to tuck their kids into bed, but he made a point of creating a little bit of a sandbox for me to kind of loosen up in and get comfortable with. And so he was really kind too.
You got to work a lot with Ellie Kemper on that show, who I think you had worked with a lot before that, right? You knew her. Was she the sort of the person you knew the best going into that show?
I knew Ellie from New York. We'd improvised together, and you know, we'd spent years in New York. We'd done touring shows together. I mean, Ellie is irresistible. She has such a wonderful combination of positivity and rage, I think. Like, she's so sunny and plucky, and she has a kind of Pippi Longstockings charm. And then she also is like just a flame, I think. I mean, this is my own, and I haven't seen Ellie in a long time, so maybe she's different now. But I remember thinking, like, wow, what an interesting combination of like American is apple pie and also a little bit of a grenade. In a great way, you know, and it made her really exciting to watch at Upright Citizens Brigade, which is the theater we both worked at, and then certainly on screen, as millions have observed.
Gabe, did Erin ever tell you that she loves you?
No.
She wouldn't even let me say it. It was adorable. She'd plug her ears and scream her heart out.
Can you stop talking? Because every word out of your mouth is like the squawk of an ugly pelican.
I got a tattoo for you.
I didn't ask you to get that Nike swoosh. Nobody did. You did that for you.
Just do it. You were the it that I was just doing.
You know, I think at that time, The Office was very popular. It's way more popular now, probably, somehow. How did you feel like it changed your life and your career getting that opportunity to be on that show?
Drastically. I mean, that was actually, it gave me a career. It gave me, you know, all kinds of access and things I wouldn't have had. It was my first brush with being recognizable. I remember like the day before the first episode aired and then the day after, and going into a bar and having someone just be like, oh, and thinking like, oh, how strange.
Yeah, that was the first time you really were recognized that way?
Yeah, and then I started reading stuff online, and that was a bad idea.
Because what kind of stuff were you reading?
I would gravitate towards whatever negative stuff I could find. And whenever I would find that, it hurt my feelings so bad. I would just read this because I already had such imposter syndrome. And, you know, it's a character who, as you said, is like, he's not a lovable character in the traditional sense, or maybe in any sense. You know, he's this kind of impotent, scheming, insecure, awkward guy. So, when I would read stuff that was cruel or even just unenthusiastic, I'd just be like, oh. I remember feeling lying on the bed in my girlfriend at the time's apartment and just being like, I don't know if I want to do this. Like, I don't know if if this is how it works, you just like do this stuff. And then there's this kind of Greek chorus of hatred. I don't know if that's something I really want to do. And what would happen is then the two things kind of blended, where I would be out, I would see someone look at me, seemingly recognize me, and then I would assign them in my head one of the terrible things I'd read. Be like, oh, that's probably like someone who feels that blank, you know, fill in terrible comment. So I got in a little bit of a tailspin with that. And then I was like, oh, I have to stop reading this. I just can never look at this stuff. I had an acting coach who I work to this day. Anytime I have an acting part, I work with her. Her name's Anya Saffer, and she's a genius. But I remember at one point telling her, I was like, you know, I'm having such a hard time. Like, this is just like, I don't know. I'm such a delicate flower. I just can't stand it when I read this stuff. And she looked at me with this kind of crazy, witchy intensity. And she got very quiet. And she smiled, this sort of strange smile. And she said, but Zach, those are the critics. And we know what we think of them. And I was like, what? She's like, we know what we think of them, right? And I was like, right. And she was like, right. And I swear to God, after that conversation, I never read anything again. It was like, it was wild.
I did not know that the part of Gabe was written for you in The Office. I mean, given everything that you said about him, what did that tell you about yourself and how the writers saw you?
Well, the only thing I'd done at that point was this movie called In the Loop, which was Armando Iannucci's first feature film.
Yeah,
and in that, movie. I played this like very backbiting kind of brittle but aggressive young staffer at the State Department. So my guess is they saw that and they were like, okay, we see what area he can play competently in.
Hey, I just want to say congratulations. Your paper got a major citation. You must be psyched that Karen brought it up.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, her call, not mine.
You couldn't write a paper that clashes more violently with the current climate than the one you wrote if you were trying. And it seems like you almost were trying.
I wasn't trying. So, okay. Believe me.
You're like the woman from The Omen. You've given birth to a demon, and now it's going to kill you.
You probably identify with the kid from The Omen, right?
Ooh.
See, you're an only child, aren't you?
I got to say, I don't understand how my parents' limited reproductive ability reflects badly on me. I'm the sperm that made it, so.
Liza.
I'm being called by our boss.
Oh, okay. Retreat.
Thank you.
See you later.
Yeah, have fun with yourself.
Okay, have fun with your career kryptonite.
I think in my case, the insecurity was something I shared with Gabe, you know, the kind of sense of maybe not being enough. But I think the difference is Gabe would become manipulative or aggressive or scheming and as a way of trying to manage that core feeling of inadequacy. Whereas for me, I think I would turn inward. I would become much more just kind of quiet and morose.
The other character that you're probably best known for is Jared on Silicon Valley. Was that one that you auditioned for? I mean, I'm sure it sort of evolved based on you and your improvisation, but who was that character on the page maybe versus who he became?
That guy on the page, well, initially I auditioned for Ehrlich, which was T.J. Miller's part. It was this kind of boisterous alpha guy.
But yeah, the two of you are pretty different performers. So.
Yeah. But I auditioned for it. When I first did it, they had him in this kind of like micro suede jacket. And he was, I think, initially was going to be a little bit more of a venture capitalist kind of slick operator guy. I just think a lot of shows are like families where they sort of adhere to a familial archetype. And I just realized somehow through the writing, through improvising, through talking to the people who were making it, that Jared was the mother, the kind of self-denying mother. yeah. And there's a writer named Carson Mell who actually helped us do some punch-up work on this one, on In the Know, who wrote the first episode after the pilot got picked up, where Jared really has stuff to do. He and I had worked together or met together, and I credit him a lot with also helping sort of shepherd Jared in a direction that felt like more where he landed ultimately.
You are still in a room with Gavin.
So we're partners. What's your point?
He and his posse of bandits and cutthroats will turn on you in a second. You need me, the half-crazed, half-Apache, who will do anything to get your back. I'll scalp Gavin if I have to, and all the rest of those pale-faced sons of bitches. I'll kill them with knives. I'll kill them with guns. I'll kill them with my hands. I'll talk them into suicide. It doesn't matter.
All right, Jared, I think what you're asking is, you want a job?
If you think you can find a place for me.
Yeah, of course, Jared. Yeah. You're more than welcome to work on this. But just to be clear, you're not going to stab anyone, are you?
Oh, it feels good to laugh.
Oh. So that's a no then?
Richard. We were talking about satirizing the public radio world. Obviously, Silicon Valley was this great satire of the tech world. What do you feel like you learned about that whole very sort of opaque to a lot of people world by working on that show for so many years?
You're very good at this. You ask really good questions.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, who am I to say you're good at it? I just mean, like, it's nice. It's an interesting... this is, like, such thoughtful questions. Sometimes you're like, yeah, I appreciate you watching it, and you've obviously, like, researched, and yeah, it's really nice. Okay, what did I learn about tech?
Yeah, and sort of who these people are, because I think they're very, like, we feel like we know a lot about them, but maybe we don't, and it's just it's an odd world that seems to only be getting stranger as time goes by.
I will say that I generally like people and I'm generally interested in people. I find most people to be sympathetic and lovable. That was also true of many of the people who I met in Silicon Valley. But I was startled by how many people I met who gave me the willies, because they would look at you with like Terminator eyes, where, you know, in the Terminator, I mean, dating myself here, but like, you know, like there's a lot of movies like this where you see a person through a robot's point of view and you can see all the data kind of scrolling on the side of the image where it's like height, weight, da 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 da, like point of origin, that, you know, and I felt like that. When I would talk to people sometimes, where I was like, I could almost like hear the scroll going on in their head and the evaluation of assets and liabilities, strengths and weaknesses. What could this person be? You know, it was just, it felt very objectifying in a weird way. That's and that, and I was thinking, if I feel objectified under these circumstances, if you were a woman in these, you know, hugely disproportionately male environments, and there's this kind of natural objectification that everyone is doing to each other, where it's this kind of, I don't know, the slightly dehumanizing gaze. And then you add on top of it the fact that you're a woman. It must just be like, oh my God, it must be. You must just want to like wear a raincoat to work to keep like the bad energy off of you. Like, and I think so. Yeah, it was a mix. There were like people who were passionate and starry-eyed and full of life and dreams. And then there were people who would look at you like you were a steak to be carved up. And and it was a very weird mix. I mean, the other thing that someone said that I thought was really interesting, one of the writers said this. He said, you know, if you imagine Mark Zuckerberg, for example, right? Just to pick one. If you imagine someone has a kind of social liability, maybe they're not, they have a difficult time interacting with people, whatever, then in a kind of enterprising and adaptive way, they create a tool for themselves to help them. But then because they're so entrepreneurial and brilliant in their way, they manage to proliferate that tool and sell that tool and get everyone using that tool. So it's like, if I need a cane because my leg is weak or, you know, I have an injury or whatever, but then I'm so entrepreneurial that I figure out a way to sell you a cane, even though your leg is fine. And then you start using this cane all the time, then your leg starts to atrophy and ends up being like my leg was when I realized I needed the cane. And he was saying that this is a pattern that you see in Silicon Valley, where people will try to have these kind of adaptive responses, social deficits in their own life, and then they will scale the adaptive tool and then everyone will atrophy in reaction to the fact that they've adapted these tools. I don't know if it's true or not, but I found it to be a fascinating interpretation of it, you know, and I've thought about it a lot since.
And meanwhile, you just joined social media in 2024.
This is really, I mean, this is, I said to, this is a gross way of putting it, but I said to my, I don't even want to say it's too horrible, but I have to say, as a 39-year-old man signing up for TikTok, there is a moment of cringy self-reflection where you're like, oh my, is this like my Corvette? Like, am I, you know what I mean? Like, am I like...
Yeah, and you're really playing to the algorithm too.
There you go. But what I'm trying to do for that is, here's my theory, right? Well, one of the things is like, I don't have a kid, right? But I think people who have kids will talk about like, well, I went to this thing and I did this song and dance that felt really compromising, but it's for my kids. So, you know, whatever. I just bit the bullet. For me with social media, it's counter to every impulse I have, but I have all these things like this show's coming out and then there's all these other things that I'm developing. I really want to make sure that those things reach an audience. And I have no idea if social media will help with that or not. But I was like, I want to leave no stone unturned. And
unfortunately, it's the reality of our world.
I like, so far, I really like TikTok because to me, TikTok is like, you're making these like weird little movies. And that feels better than just being like, here's me in a cardigan. Like the idea of like putting pictures.
Back to your UCB days.
Yeah, like making like little movies, like that's fun and silly. Like I'm down for that. But something about just being like, here's my family on Christmas. No shade to anyone who does it, but no, it just feels scary to me. I just wouldn't, I just have no instinct.
You're
for
taking
that.
A different approach.
For now. Wait to tomorrow. You'll see a picture of my family and we're all in bikinis. With all like right, products, so, yeah. With like holding like building products.
Hashtag ad, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So now it's time. We're going to end with our segment called The First Laugh. So we're going to run through some of these questions about firsts in your life and career, starting with the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up. What comes to mind as something that just really connected with you?
There was a children's book where there was a picture of a man and a bear, and it said, algae met a bear. The bear met algae. The bear was bulgy. The bulge was algae. And it's the story of a man meeting a bear and then being eaten by the bear and then becoming a bulge in the bear's belly. I remember as a little kid thinking that was very, I thought that was, and something about the sound of it, algae met a bear met algae. The bear was bulgy. The bulge was algae. Yeah, I like
clearly
that.
Stuck with you.
Yeah, it did.
Do you remember the first time that you felt like you were funny, that you could make other people laugh?
Tomorrow, baby. That's what I'm hoping for.
Any day now.
Yeah, I'm waiting. I went on TikTok. Hopefully that'll help.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I know you started comedy very young. You started at UCB at 16, which is, you know, I think anyone who does that really kind of knows what they want or sort of were going for it at a young age. Do you remember the first like real laugh that you got at UCB, whether it was in a class or in a show or something where you felt like you might have some sort of skill at improv and in that world?
Well, the truth is I was just kind of going to fuck around. I was not some driven comedy aspirant. I wasn't thinking like, I want a career in comedy. I had wanted to be a jazz musician, and that had kind of seemed decreasingly likely. So then I had all this time where I used to be like playing jazz, and I was like, oh, this sounds fun. I'll just try this. I think if I had to carry the weight of professional ambition through that, it would have stopped me. But I think because it felt like kind of a lark, I was just like, okay, let's go. But quickly, then I became very invested in it. First laugh. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that, but I do remember on my first day of my first class of improv school, they asked everyone to go around and say what had brought them to the class. And I went, train. The teacher, who is this guy, Billy Merritt, who's a genius of an improviser and a very kind man, was like, okay, but what really brought you? And then I said, well, I'm 45 years old, but I have a condition that makes me look like a young boy. And everyone gave me like a pity laugh, like, ha, ha, ha. And then I was like, no, really. And then everyone got really quiet because they were like, oh, maybe this guy's really sick. And then I was like, nah, you know, like I was just like,
you were ready to do bits, right?
I was day so one. Obnoxious. I was so it was so obnoxious. It was so inappropriate to the environment. It was so thirsty and weird. And Billy Merritt, who like Allison Jones, was like someone who at an early point could have totally clipped my wings, but out of the goodness of their hearts did not. Was like, okay, like, you know, he kind of is like gentle about it. I will be forever in his debt because I don't know that I would have been as generous, but he was so sweet with me and sort of says like, oh, this kid's just nervous. He's just trying to make himself at home.
Do you remember the first time you met one of your comedy heroes and what that experience was like to meet them for the first time?
I sat in a room with Norm Macdonald once and didn't say a word. I was with Mike Judge.
What was the room? Yeah.
It was at some festival or something. I might've been at like Montreal Just for Laughs or South by Southwest. I really don't remember. All I have is this image of me in a room sitting with Mike Judge and Norm Macdonald and not being able to talk.
Were they talking?
Not that much. A little.
Is there something in your career that you said no to that you now kind of wish that you had said yes to?
Harry Potter. I should have taken it. I mean, just the money would have been really life-changing. And to be clear.
Yeah, it would have, yeah.
Yeah. And to be clear, they wanted me to play. They were going to make Hermione male because they were right, so impressed by my audition.
On the flip side, anything that you said yes to that you now kind of wish you had said no to?
That's a great, oh yeah. Early on, I did this weird TV pilot that some guy had like sold his house in England to pay for. And he was like, my wife said, don't sell the house. But I was like, fuck it. I'm going to sell the house. And then it was this insane, insane pilot that we shot. Like they used one of the actresses' houses as like a location. Then there was this like horrible joke in the pilot where it was this woman, she was black and she was talking about her son and there was some reference to his penis. And the actress who was playing this character appropriately didn't want to make a joke about her. It was just, it was basically a racist joke. And this woman was like, you know, I'm really not comfortable with that. And the director responded by pulling me into the hallway and being like, do you think I should fire her? Meanwhile, we're in her house. And I've never acted in anything. And I was like, I don't know. Like, no, like you're in her house. Like, what are you talking about?
Like, where are we going to shoot now?
Yeah. And I was also just like, this is right. Like, I just had this dawning realization where like, what the fuck is this? This is like, this is a guy who's just like really capitalizing on the desperation of unemployed actors to make them like do compromising things that aren't funny and make them feel bad. And then there's this kid in it who I guess they've like flown in from, or no. I think he was like a, I think he must have been like a Russian immigrant or something. I think his parents had moved here first because they wouldn't have had the money to fly him in from Russia. And at one point, the shooting day was going so long. It was taking forever. And this kid was getting restless and he was playing and, you know, just being a kid. And the director went up to him and went, hey, he's like, you settle down or I will send you back to Russia. And it's like, this guy's a psychopath. So I wish I hadn't done that.
Well, at least it didn't get picked up.
No, that was Silicon Valley. It went through a lot of rewrites.
Yeah, but, wow. Yeah. It lasted a long time.
Yeah.
Finally, is there a story or memory from your career that really makes you laugh now, but was not funny when it happened?
I mean, it was a little funny when it happened, but I used to do commercials, like audition for commercials to pay the bills. Sometimes we'd shoot commercials. And I remember showing up to do a commercial audition where it was like 10 a.m. It was kind of like just north of Union Square. It was cold out in my memory. And I walked into this like fluorescent lit casting room and they're like, okay, here's a spot. You're going to put on this Rastafarian wig with the and you're going to take, they go, take your shirt off, put on this Rastafarian wig. And then there's going to be a woman, you're going to feed her a Starburst with your fingers. And I was like, okay, I think it was a Starburst. There's some candy. I don't remember. Anyway. So I did this audition where I was shirtless and this poor woman is like I wouldn't want to in an audition eat candy off of like some strange person's hand. So we were both auditioning. So anyway, so I'm in this Rastafarian wig under the fluorescent lights. But the thing that happens when I took off my shirt, I have something called a pectus excavatum, which is like a little dent in my chest. So I saw the casting director just like look at it, like kind of perplexed. And then I was just like, oh, there's no way I'm going to get this part because you have to be shirtless and they don't, you know, I have a hole in my chest. So then... So I knew I wasn't getting the part. And then they realized like they'd scheduled it wrong. So there weren't enough guys. So they're like, do you mind just staying? We want you to just stay and read with everyone. So for like 45 minutes, I just stood in this fluorescent room with my shirt off and my Rastafarian wig feeding women Starbursts or whatever, or Kit Kats, or I don't remember what it was. But and that was really like, wow. When I think of like my immigrant great grandparents traveling from Russia to have a new life, if they knew that their great grandson was like shirtless in a Rastafarian wig, like giving people colds, like
yeah, that's a real like what am I doing moment.
Yeah, it's a real what am I doing moment.
Well, I'm glad everything worked out after that.
Has it? I hope so. We'll see.
I think so. Yeah. Well, the new show is great. In the Know, I really really liked it, and I think that people are going to enjoy it. And yeah, Zach, it's been really, really fun talking with you and getting to know you. And yeah, good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. Thanks for talking to me. And thanks for watching the show and asking such thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it. You are very different from Lauren Caspian.
Oh, that's good to know.
Okay, bye.
Thank you to Zach Woods for being my guest on this week's show. You can stream all 6 episodes of In the Know starting tomorrow, January 25th, on Peacock. I really hope you check it out. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.